The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walser, a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth. Book your free call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. That's friendofdinesh.com. Coming up, I'm going to review the results of yesterday's primaries, which are a window into the future of the Republican Party. The new CNN chief is making a, quote, apology tour to Republican officials, promising them the network will cover them fairly in the future. I'll invoke Muhammad Ali to show why reparations for slavery is a really dumb idea. Trump attorney John Eastman joins me. We're going to talk about the thuggery of the left, the January 6th committee, and I'll continue my discussion of Patroclus in Homer's Iliad. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
America needs this voice. The times are crazy, and a time of confusion, division, and lies. We need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
I want to comment on the primary results from yesterday's election and try to draw out the significance of those results. Trump seems to have had a really good day. He endorsed about 42 candidates, but the races that were really focused on were the race with Peter Meyer and John Gibbs. This was a race in Michigan. Peter, I think it's Meyer, M-E-I-J-E-R. This is a guy, by the way, a multimillionaire with a supermarket fortune. His name is all over the state. I think he thought he was invincible. He had a lot more money. His challenger was a guy, not very well known, named John Gibbs. But the challenger had one thing, and that's the endorsement of Trump. And of course, there was, I think, a lot of pent-up frustration at Peter Meyer for voting for the Trump impeachment with no basis, with no justification. So this is one of those guys that just needs to be swept out with the garbage. And sure enough, he was. And so Peter Meyer is out. John Gibbs will now be the Republican candidate. It's going to be a difficult election in November for him because he's in a redistricted sort of Democrat plus 10. But the most important thing is the fact that Meyer is out. And this is a struggle that's going on within the GOP. This struggle was particularly dramatically illustrated by what's happening in Arizona. And that's really what I want to focus on. Now, you might remember Rusty Bowers. He's the state senator running for state senate for and he lost. This was the guy who appeared before the January 6th committee, acted like he's, you know, true to his lofty principles. He never saw any evidence of election fraud. Trump was asking him to do the impossible. And I guess the voters went, well, you know, we've kind of had enough of you, Rusty. Sayonara and goodbye. So he's out. I'll come back to Arizona in a minute. Let me finish it with Missouri here. There was kind of a little weirdness in Missouri because Trump endorsed Eric. But as it turns out, there are two Erics in the race. And I don't know if Trump was like, you know what, I like them both. I don't want to pick between them. I'm just going to endorse Eric. And of course, both Erics said, it's me. Trump's endorsed me. So Eric Greitens, who was on the podcast. And then, of course, Eric Schmidt, the Attorney General of Missouri, who was also on the podcast, but when about several months ago, I think. In any case, Eric Schmidt is the winner of the GOP nomination. So one of the two Erics made it and will now be in the Senate race in November. Now back to Arizona, where the Trump-backed candidate, this is This is Blake Masters, easily won. And so he now becomes the GOP candidate to face the incumbent Democratic Senator Mark Kelly. Very interestingly, Mark Fincham, a big proponent of 2,000 mules and somebody who is focused on the issue of election fraud. This is why the left calls him an election denier. Election denier. These days, if you expose fraud, you're an election denier. I think it's just a strategy somewhat similar to the mafia. I remember when, you know, you go after the mafia, they'd be like, this is prejudice against Italian Americans. You're implying that every Italian American is a crook and a criminal. No, we're not implying that. We're just going after the crooks and the criminals. And the same here, this election denialism is supposed to be some kind of an epithet that's supposed to scare people. Well, to the degree that it means going after election fraud and protecting free elections, there's nothing wrong with being an election denialist. We're really fraud denialists, if you want to put it that way. Anyway, Mark Fincham wins the Republican Secretary of State nomination. And now we turn to the governor's race. And here's Meghan McCain. This is early on yesterday. She goes, wow, Lake is getting crushed so far. Incredible. Everybody better turn to primetime. If this lunatic loses, she's going to go absolute insane on live TV. Like one for the books makes Trump look normal insane. So you can see, you know, Meghan McCain is starting to gloat. She's like, we got the McCain family. We put all this money in. You know, the candidate running against Lake is married to a multimillionaire, if not a billionaire. So they outspend Carrie Lake. You know, in comes Mike Pence. So a lot of it was at stake here because in some ways the Republican establishment is also, I don't know if grooming is the right word, but they're sort of grooming Pence. And in order to groom Pence, you got to show that the Pence endorsement can carry a rival to Carrie Lake all the way to the nomination. And so not only that, but the former governor, Doug Ducey, also strong endorsement of Karen Taylor Robson, and it was looking sort of tricky for Carrie Lake for a while there. Carrie Lake was behind most of the day yesterday, I guess partly because they counted the mail-in ballots first, but then when the day votes came in from yesterday itself, Carrie Lake surpasses Karen Taylor Robson. I don't think she's been officially declared the winner, but to me this is important on two counts. First, it's because it shows the MAGA takeover of the GOP. Carrie Lake represents the MAGA wing of the party. Not to say the Republican establishment has no strength. They were able to make this much closer than many people thought. But second, Carrie Lake is focused on the election integrity issue. She's been all over 2,000 mules. In fact, one of the most vocal and eloquent defenders of 2,000 mules, even in hostile TV environments. And so it's fantastic to see her get across the finish line. I think she'll be a formidable candidate going into November. Guys, if you can believe it, Mike Lindell is now making coffee. What? He's in the coffee business and we got our supply. We love it. It's great stuff. Now, you don't get it from my pillow, but you get it from my store, mystore.com. So here's Mike talking about it. Make sure you order some coffee.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell, and I'm excited to announce my new product, My Coffee. I get products all the time from entrepreneurs for my new platform, mystore.com. And when I tried My Coffee for the first time, I was blown away. It is the best coffee I've ever had in my life. I spent the last 4 months doing my due diligence, and this family-owned business micromanages every step from the fields to the cup to ensure the best quality coffee you're ever going to have. It starts with the beans that are grown in Honduras. Honduras's volcanic soil and humid climate make the perfect growing conditions for coffee plants, which produce the best beans ever. Then each batch is tested for its aroma, taste, and other aspects to meet the highest standards in the coffee industry. And after that, it goes into production, which is all done right here in the USA. It's like you're getting that small batch specialty coffee, but delivered right to your front door. So go to mystore.com or call the number on your screen. Use the promo code and you'll get your very own My Coffee for 25% off. You guys all know that I've traveled the country for the past year and a half. I've stayed in hundreds of hotels. I've tried every coffee out there. Well, some of the coffees have that terrible aftertaste, some that leave me jittery, or I get an upset stomach. Well, my coffee is different. It's the richest, smoothest, best coffee I've ever had. My coffee comes in a variety of flavors. You get them ground or whole bean. Plus, it's certified organic and non-GMO. I guarantee it'll be the best coffee you've ever had. So go to mystore.com or call the number on your screen. Use your promo code and you'll get my coffee for 25% off. And I'm going to give you deep discounts on all my store products. That's mystore.com. It's my new platform for USA entrepreneurs. Please order now.
CNN has a new boss. The CEO is a guy named Chris Licht. L-I-C-H-T. Debbie's like, Chris Licht? What kind of a name is that? Sometimes people have weird names. It would be nice if everybody had a really normal name like Dinesh D'Souza. Instead, we got all these eccentric names, people, you know. Chris Licht, really. Anyway, this guy evidently has been camping out in the Capitol, talking to Republican senators. And he has been seeking out private meetings with them. In fact, he does it sort of surreptitiously, so it's not covered in the media. But evidently his goal is to try to make peace with Republican senators. What he's telling them is, please come back. Back is the key word. And be interviewed on CNN. Now, the Republican senator has stopped going on CNN. They're invited, but they go, no, I'm not coming on CNN. I can't expect fair treatment. You've got these nakedly hostile hosts who scream at you and, smarmy and smug and make all these sarcastic comments. Who needs it? Why should we do it? Who are we appealing to? That's not our audience anyway. And CNN is so much ideologically dug in on the other side that Republican senators are like, give it a pass. By the way, this is also kind of my approach. I frequently get texts from, I'm writing you from, you know, the Daily Beast, and I'm trying to confirm or deny. And I'm like, no response. That's the right approach. We just ignore the other side. And they're not used to that. They're used to us jumping up and down and trying to justify ourselves and so on. We don't need to do that. So Chris Licht now realizes it's not hurting the Republicans, it's hurting CNN. And so he's like, please come back. And he goes, we'll treat you fairly. And the Republican senators are like, well, how do we know that? And they're like, well, he's like, you know, I'm going to be talking to our producers about doing that. I'm going to praise the producers who are featuring both sides. Now, obviously, this is, I think, well motivated by Chris Licht, because CNN in the old days had shows like Crossfire, which did reflect both sides. And if you had a CNN panel, you generally have a range of views. But no, once Jeff Zucker got into the driver's seat, he changed it. He basically made CNN the ideological arm of the Democratic left. And a CNN panel typically was like seven guys who could be measured by various degrees of rabid hostility to Trump. And this has basically burned the CNN brand. Now, if I were Chris Licht, I would go in there with a blowtorch and basically send, you know, Stelter and Acosta to the pavement immediately. And then I would tell everybody else to turn in a pink slip, Jake Tapper, Fareed Zakaria, all these clowns on CNN. And then I would have a talk with each one of them to see if any of them should be kept on. Now, Licht hasn't done that. In fact, he hasn't fired a single high-profile host at CNN. But evidently, he's trying this kind of Republican courtship idea to try to see if he can get Republicans back on CNN. My advice to Republican senators is don't do it. Hold off. Say to Chris Licht, well, you know what? If you claim that CNN is going to be balanced, is going to have different points of view, why don't you start by proving it? You don't need Republican senators at the outset. Let's see if you can bring in Republican commentators, conservative ideas, yeah, and not just the never Trumpers. The never Trumpers represent what, 2% of the party, if even that. So that is not this kind of staged Republican who's there for the purpose of bashing Trump is not going to do the trick. Show that you reflect the mainstream of the Republican Party, the mainstream of conservative thinking on your network, and then we'll see. Some of us wish we could rewind the clock when it comes to our health. Hey, exercising, climbing stairs, all the things young people take for granted, these aren't things that have to stop just because you get older. Neither do you have to just endure patiently the normal aging aches and pains. Why? Because now there's a 100% drug-free solution. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor love it. They order more because it works for them. Debbie's excited. She's a true believer. She finally gets to do her bar exercise class now that she's alleviated her frozen shoulder thanks to Relief Factor. Debbie's even able to do planks and push-ups, so she's like, wow, I never want to be without this again. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of only $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number again, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. I mentioned yesterday on the podcast a scheme by Robert Johnson, the head of the BET, the Black Entertainment TV, who has come up with this big, expensive reparations program, $350,000 paid by the U.S. government, one-time cash payment to every African-American. 42 million African-Americans would be counted as the eligible descendants of slavery, a $14.7 trillion price tag. And I meant to say a few things about reparations, the idea itself, but I didn't have a chance to do it yesterday, so I'm going to pick up on it today. Very interestingly, Frederick Douglass, the greatest Black American of our history, in my view, greater than Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was an important figure, but I would rank him third, maybe fourth. Frederick Douglass, himself a slave, of course, in his early life, then later a great abolitionist leader, also a diplomat, a marvelous writer, wrote actually 3 autobiographies. And Douglass was asked, does America owe something to the slaves whose labor had been stolen? And remarkably, Douglass said no. Asked, quote, what should be done for the former slaves? This is Douglass's answer. Do nothing with us. Your doing with us has already played the mischief. Do nothing with us. If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall. All I ask is give him a chance to stand on his own legs. Let him alone. If you will only untie his hands and give him a chance, I think he will live. So here's Douglass basically saying that even for people who have directly suffered the depredations of slavery, all they're asking for, all they want, and all they should get is equal opportunity, equal rights under the law. That's it. That's enough. Now, interestingly, fast forward to another great in his own way, or certainly great in his own mind, I am the greatest. We're talking about Muhammad Ali, a great in the field of boxing. And Muhammad Ali, after he won the title, got it back, defeating George Foreman in Zaire, the so-called Rumble in the Jungle. When Ali came back to America, he was confronted by I believe it was a journalist, but it may not have been, somebody who yells out at him as he comes off the plane, hey champ, well, what do you think of Africa? And Ali gave a very interesting response, thank God my granddaddy got on that boat. Now, this is Ali being Ali, speaking with a kind of pungency that only Ali is capable of. But I think there's actually a profound point that Ali is making. And the point is this, that even though slavery was terrible for the slaves, how do we assess the impact of slavery on the descendants of slaves? Particularly when you consider, and this is what Ali is getting at about my granddaddy getting on the boat, slavery was the transmission belt that brought all these Africans into the orbit of Western freedom. Now, they were initially denied that freedom by being enslaved, but their descendants have it, and they've had it, they have it now, and they've had it for 150 years since the abolition of slavery. Now, you might say, well, what about segregation and so on? Yeah, segregation was, in fact, also a deprivation, obviously not as bad a deprivation as slavery. So you can argue about the degree and the date. You can say, well, Black Americans really didn't enjoy full freedom until until 1954, the Brown decision, or 1964, the Civil Rights Act. But even if you take that date, it means that pretty much every African-American alive today, every African-American born, let's say, in 1954 or later, which is over the past 70 years, has in fact lived in an atmosphere of freedom. And how'd they get here? How'd they get here if not for... So the paradox I'm getting at is it took slavery to bring this population of Africans into a land where they can enjoy the rights that are today not available in many other countries, including many, many African countries. And the point is that while slavery... By the way, you could say the same about colonialism. I made the point in an article I did many years ago. It was called Two Cheers for Colonialism. I wrote it in the Chronicle Review, which is the magazine of the Chronicle of Higher Education. And I made the point that colonialism, too, was bad for the people who lived under it. My great-grandfather, his grandfather, my grandfather, who lived in the last days of British colonialism, they were treated as second-class citizens. They were treated almost like they were a servant class. No matter how smart they were, how well-educated, it was like, you know, you're below me because you're brown and I'm white. So that stung. That certainly took a toll. But... my question is, what about the descendants of colonialism, people like me, who as a result of colonialism grew up in a society where, for example, I learn English, where I learn respect for rule of law. I learn about all these principles of separation of powers and checks and balances and a democratic system of government and human rights, and even India's technological sophistication in today's world, largely driven by the fact that India became a westernized country under the British. And so again, while my great-grandfather might have a lot of complaints against colonialism, the Indians of my generation don't. Food costs are skyrocketing, and according to industry sources, grocery stores across the U.S. are worried about food shortages. As a result, survival food is more important than ever. If you stockpile the wrong foods, you could be setting up your family to go hungry in a crisis. Well, now you can create your very own stockpile of the best-selling Four Patriots. That's the number Four Patriots survival food kits. Four Patriots survival food kits are a tremendous value. This is not ordinary food. This is delicious, nutritious, good for 25 years survival food. And customers rave about the terrific flavor. Go to 4patriots.com, the number 4patriots.com/Dinesh. You'll get 3 months survival food kit and your free gifts worth $273. And for a limited time, get $100 off your order. Wow, these survival food kits are famous for selling out, but now they're back, and you'll get loaded up with free gifts when you get yours today. Go to 4patriots.com/Dinesh, grab your 3-month survival food kit, all your free gifts, and $100 off for a limited time. That's 4patriots.com/Dinesh. Guys, I got a terrific guest today on the podcast. It's Dr. John Eastman, founding director of the Claremont Institute Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, senior fellow of the Claremont Institute, and also until recently, Henry Salvatore Professor of Law at the Chapman University in California. John has also been a lawyer for Trump, and this is actually what we want to talk about, is the actions of the left in trying to go after John and others for their work for former President Trump. John, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me. We actually go kind of way back. As you might remember, I was a Publius Fellow at the Claremont Institute right after Dartmouth. And that's where I met the whole gang of Claremonsters, as we might call them, who have had such a tremendous influence on American public policy. You've gone on to a really distinguished career. I'd like you to start by just talking about those kind of tense days in the maybe even leading up to the election, but certainly in the aftermath of the election. What is it that you did that is supposedly now driving the left off a cliff and causing them to sort of summon this big kind of lynch mob against you, as if to say that you are a grave enemy of the country and the Constitution?
Well, in fact, in one of the litigations I'm currently involved with, the January 6th committee actually says, not only was I wrong, but I was dangerous. I guess the danger there lies in standing up and speaking the truth to power. And I'm catching the same kind of assault that you've been under, Dinesh, for the terrific movie you did, 2000 Mules, that starts to expose some of the corruption. You focus there on some very important evidence of outright fraud. I focused mostly on the evidence of illegality. Our Constitution is very clear. Article 2 of the Constitution gives to the legislatures of the states the plenary power to, quote, direct the manner of choosing presidential electors. Most people would find this odd today, but for the first half century of our nation's history, the legislators just chose the electors themselves. And even when they submit that decision to popular vote, as all the states have done since the Civil War, the manner that they set out is the election code. And when you had non-legislative officials, secretaries of state, county clerks, what have you, simply ignoring the existing election code laws on absentee ballots, on the requirement of signature verification, all of these steps that the legislatures put in to prevent fraud from occurring because it's so difficult to discover it after the fact, those things were just dispensed with by non-legislative officials. And that meant that the election was conducted illegally, even unconstitutionally. And that's what we focused on. And the left doesn't want anybody talking about that, at least not talking about it since 2020. Of course, they talked about it a lot in 2018 and 2016 and what have you. And so what they are now attempting to do is criminalize those that spoke up against the admitted illegality in the conduct of the election. That is, as your movie and other investigations are showing, actually led to the very fraud that those statutory restrictions were put in place to try and prevent.
John, you're making a crucial point here, and I want to slow it down because I want to make sure I understand it clearly. What you're saying is that even though Trump believed there was fraud, and there were, of course, accusations of fraud from the very beginning, you're saying that your argument didn't really depend on that. It didn't depend upon being able to prove instance A, B, C, or D of fraud. You're saying that there is a process that needs to be in place for the Constitution to be upheld. The Constitution dictates how elections should be conducted and who should run them. And the Constitution specifies that the answer to that is state legislatures. And so when the state legislatures and what they specifically put in the code is undercut by secretaries of state, by other officials, then in a sense we have an illegally conducted election, even if you're unable to prove any fraud at all. Am I correct in summarizing that as the argument you're making?
That's right. And the reason that's so important is because of how difficult it is to prove fraud after the fact. And I'll give you one very good example. Wisconsin prohibits drop boxes, unmanned drop boxes, what have you. They also require extensive signature verification and witness signatures on the absentee ballots before they're counted. And the law is very clear. If it doesn't include those things, the ballot shall not be counted. Now, once you separate the ballot from the envelope and after the fact try and determine, well, that one didn't have a signature. How do we know that was actually the illegal voter who cast that ballot? Well, you could say, okay, there, and now we've got evidence of fraud, but how was the vote cast? The ballot is now separated from the envelope, and it can't be proved which way it went. In 2018, in North Carolina's 9th Congressional District, there was an illegal ballot harvesting scheme that was conducted on behalf of one of the candidates, without his knowledge, I might point out. But the elections board said, we cannot prove then, given the number of illegal ballots that were collected, we can't prove or certify what the actual result of the election is. And they ordered a new election. This is the reason these rules are in place ahead of time. There was massive cheating that went on. Whether that actually produced the fraud that it was designed to make it difficult to accomplish or not is immaterial to the illegality that occurred. And that's what I tried to focus on in our Supreme Court briefs, both in my motion to intervene on behalf of President Trump in the Texas litigation, but in a cert petition filed from Pennsylvania on three of the illegally changed statutes. I mean, they changed the deadlines. They changed the signature verification. They said, oh, if you're in the room in the Philadelphia Convention Center, which is about as big as a football field, standing all the way at one end, that's good enough to be able to observe what's happening 100 yards away. I mean, it was insane. And they threw out the ability for people to make any election challenge. They said, even though we've been doing signature verification for 100 years, we don't find that anywhere in the statutes. And in those statutory provisions that seem to acknowledge it, those are just archaic relics. We're just going to ignore them. I mean, this is what the court actually said. And the notion that we can change the rules. And by the way, some of that went on after the election. Up to 2 weeks after the election, they were still changing the rules for partisan benefit in Pennsylvania. This kind of stuff, we used to call it cheating. And they're now trying to go after criminally those people who are calling them out on the illegality, the unconstitutionality, and the cheating.
John, let's take a pause. When we come back, I want to go into that. I want to go into the effort, not just by the January 6th committee, but also by other leftist organizations to target Trump lawyers and act as if serving your client is in some ways a kind of legal malpractice, if not worse. We'll be right back. It's pretty colorful at the grocery store in the produce section. All those vibrant colors of fruits and veggies, the reds, the greens. Our friend Dr. Howard at Balance of Nature says that the colors you see represent nutritional variety. Now, I don't eat anywhere near the 10 daily servings of fruits and veggies I need, so Balance of Nature is the way I give my body what it needs to stay healthy. This is why Debbie and I take these 6 little fruits and veggie capsules every day. Each daily dose is made up of a blend of 31 different fruits and veggies. 31. So variety equals vitality. Give your body everything it needs with Balance of Nature. Invest in your health. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for years to come. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code America. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751, or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code America. I'm back with my friend John Eastman, founding director of the Claremont Institute Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, also a lawyer who was advising Trump on the issue of the election. John, we're talking about the concerted effort on the part of the left. I know David Brock has some kind of a group doing this, going after Trump lawyers. And then the January 6th committee is the kind of official vehicle for doing this. What are they trying to say about you and others like you? And why is this, so dangerous, what they're trying to do, from the point of view of the rule of law?
Well, they repeat the mantra, the false statements that have been in the New York Times and the Washington Post. Every time a news account claims that the allegations of illegality and fraud in the election were baseless, that's a lie. Right. I mean, it's a blatant lie. And then they build on that lie to try and construct a criminal conspiracy case against people. I've got a memo out there that was done for internal discussion purposes, doing what lawyers always do, lay out all of the possible scenarios, some well supported by the law, some dealing with questions in the law that have not been resolved yet. And my memo actually laid out 9 different scenarios. I think 5 of them had Biden winning. Right? And the one that I actually recommended, and I'm on a public record of saying this, the one I actually recommended to the vice president was he merely accede to requests from hundreds of state legislators to send things back to delay the proceedings so that they now were back in normal session, could look at the impact the acknowledged illegality had on their election. And if it affected the outcome of the election, to do something about it. And the memo, which of course everybody hides and, doesn't cover, specifically said, if the legislatures determined that whatever illegality occurred wasn't significant enough to have affected the outcome, then they should report back and recertify the Biden electors and Biden would win. That's what the memo says. But nobody covers that. They say, but if they found significant evidence of a fraud or illegality that affected the outcome of election, then they have the constitutional authority to do something about it. That's perfectly sensible legal advice. It's an open question on whether the vice president could have delayed things like that, whether the vice president has authority under the 12th Amendment and the original text of the Constitution to make judgments about the validity of electors. There have been serious scholars that have argued that he does. Jefferson, Adams, Richard Nixon all did that. it's not like this was made up out of whole cloth. But now they're trying to make it into something nefarious that lawyers laying out options to their clients and discussing the strengths and weaknesses of the various options is somehow criminal. It's insane. And David Brock and this group, the 65 Project, that have said their goal is not just to disbar any attorney that worked on any of the election challenges, but to shame them and make them toxic in their communities and their law firms. This is an effort to shut down a valid legal representation of clients and causes with which the hard left disagrees. And when you do that, you so skew the adversarial litigation process as to destroy our great system of justice. And it seems to me that that's ultimately what they're bent on. They filed a bar complaint against me in the Supreme Court of the United States last week. And we have filed a hard-hitting response to it. But their complaint asked the Supreme Court to immediately suspend me from the practice of law in the Supreme Court. I've got clients up there right now, and before a hearing and before an investigation, and then only after that to go ahead and disbar me as well. I mean, they're throwing out due process. They're throwing out any notion of evidence. They're throwing out any notion of presumption of innocence. This really is a full frontal assault on our system of justice directly, rather than just any particular item or particular individual. And I think it's got to be fought back against with everything we've got, because it's a precious thing, this rule of law that we have. And they are trying to destroy it by claiming the mantle of defending the rule of law. It's this kind of jujitsu that they do. But their complaint against me is full of false statements, and we fired back. And so we'll see what happens.
Are you getting any support from the, you know, we always worry, is the Republican establishment going to do anything? Or are they just standing on the sidelines and saying, hey, John, you know, you fend for yourself. This is not our fight. This is your fight. Talk a little bit about whether you're getting support at all from either the RNC or from the Republican establishment.
Yeah, I don't. The Republican establishment and the Democrat establishment are hard to distinguish anymore. I call it the D.C. Uniparty, and they are opposed to anybody that would raise questions and push back against the status quo. I mean, let's face it, we've got a $3 to $5 trillion annual budget that is just making a whole lot of people in Washington rich, and neither side of the political aisle wants anybody out there challenging that status quo. And the reason they were so vitriolic in their hatred of Donald Trump is he was punching them back in the nose for some of this stuff. And he had a movement that he didn't create. I date this movement back to the Tea Party and the opposition to the takeover of our healthcare system by the centralized government in Washington, D.C. But he saw it, and he was a brawler, and he got ahead of that movement and helped lead that movement. And he posed, and his movement posed a serious threat to the sinecures of Washington, D.C. And I think that's why they're going after it so hard, trying to discredit so hard, and to trying to take on. And, you know, I mean, I suppose I should be honored that they've made me a kind of centerpiece of their attacks, because I think it means they see that I'm effective and prominent enough to need to take out. But this is why it's so important to fight it back this stuff. So, no, I'm not getting any help at all from the Republican establishment. We're doing it on our own. If people want to help, they can go to givesendgo.com/Eastman, where we've got a legal defense fund. And we keep having to raise the goal because they keep coming at us with new stuff. But people can help. More importantly, that's a wonderful website. People can send prayers of support as well at that website. My wife and I read them. And it's heartwarming to see some of the things that people say in the prayer function of that site as well.
Absolutely, folks. I urge you to check it out and to help John in this cause. John, you've been you've been under fierce attack for what you did, and what you did is totally legitimate. So thanks for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you very much, Dinesh, and good luck to you. And thank you again for that 2000 Mules movie. It's so important to get that story out.
Appreciate it. I've been doing almost a series on this podcast called Geo-Tracking Doesn't Work, Ha Ha Ha. In other words, what I've been trying to expose is the fact that this admittedly relatively new, but nevertheless very precise and very reliable technology, is relied upon in many walks of life. It's relied upon by intelligence agencies. It's relied upon by the military and the CIA. It's used for targeting. It's relied upon by the FBI. It was used in January 6th. It's relied upon by law enforcement on a daily basis. It's relied upon by the CDC, commercial companies by geo-tracking data. And the geo-tracking is adequate to the purpose, which is to say, the commercial companies want to know, are you near their store? In some cases, they want to know if you're in their store and which aisle are you in? Or even, what are you looking at? What height are you standing at? And are you looking at the top shelf or the middle shelf? So geo-tracking is evidently good enough to do all this. And yet the fact checkers, in the context of 2,000 mules, geo-tracking is very unreliable. Geo-tracking doesn't really work. And of course, supported unbelievably by Bill Barr, who claims that in a big city with people milling around, it is not possible to actually track individuals who are stopping at designated locations. In this case, drop boxes. Barr acts like that is some kind of impossible task. You're going to catch all kinds of taxi drivers going back and forth, pedestrians going past the drop boxes. So this kind of nonsensical refutation, this kind of foolishness, is exposed again and again and again when we find news article after news article reporting that geo-tracking is delivering the goods. Geo-tracking is adequate to the purpose. And the latest is Ayman al-Zawahiri. I'm talking about the Al-Qaeda number two. I'm talking about bin Laden's longtime deputy, the guy who was killed in a drone strike. So here's an interesting article in Bloomberg that describes how that occurred. I just want to read a couple of sentences from it because it gives you the scoop. It says that Ayman al-Zawahiri in Afghanistan, it took several months of intelligence work to track the terrorist family to Kabul, and identify the target, according to National Security Council spokesman John Kirby. So this is the language of geo-tracking. You're tracking people, you're identifying the target. And here's Kirby. He points out that it was through geo-tracking that the government, the U.S. government, figured out that al-Zawahiri had moved into Afghanistan. So evidently he was not in Afghanistan, but they tracked him moving to Afghanistan. And now I'm continuing with the article. The U.S. received indications that Zawahiri had moved into Afghanistan's capital by tracking his family members. They tracked the phones of his family members after pinpointing his residence, another key term. They were able not merely to approximately say, oh, he lives in this street, but we don't really know where. After pinpointing their residence, officials studied his movements and habits to determine a so-called pattern of life and conclude they had identified their target. It's by building a pattern of life. That's key to geo-tracking, and that's very important because it's true even with the mules. It's not just a matter of getting people who are going to the drop boxes. You then follow them back. Where'd they come from? Well, they came from the vote stash house. They came from the left-wing nonprofit organization. Well, do they normally do this when it's not election time? Turns out they don't. So the pattern of life is the kind of complex way in which you're able to look not just at a single moment or even a single movement on the part of a mule, but you're able to establish that this is the guy you're looking for. So the exact same technology is being used in pretty much the exact same way, in this case to kill a leading terrorist. We are in book 16 of the Iliad, and the scene where Patroclus, the young, quote, gentle Patroclus, is come to Achilles, in Achilles' words, crying like a little girl, to beg Achilles first to return to battle. Achilles will not, even though implored to do so by Patroclus. And then Patroclus offers his plan B. He says to Achilles, quote, let me wear your armor. If the Trojans think I am you, they'll back off and give the Greeks some breathing space, what little there is in war. So war doesn't often afford breathing space, but we might get a respite if we're able to flummox, mislead the Trojans into thinking, wow, Achilles is back into battle. And then Homer says, kind of echoing Achilles' own analogy or simile, that was how Patroclus, like a child begging for a toy, begged for death. So Homer is giving us, and Homer does this repeatedly in the Iliad, either through the voice of our God or through the, you may say, omniscience of the narrator. He doesn't present to us death as something of a surprise. What's going to happen to Patroclus? Wow, is he going to be okay? Homer tells you in advance, this is not good for Patroclus. He's going to go in there and he's going to be killed. He's going to kill a lot of people first, but he's going to be killed eventually. And then Achilles, replying to Patroclus, says something very interesting. He says, in effect, I will not go into battle, quote, but I never meant to hold my grudge forever. I did say I would not relent from my anger until the noise of battle lapped at my own ship's hulls. So Achilles is saying to Patroclus, first, that even when he was angry before, he didn't intend to nurse this grudge permanently, forever. He wanted to teach Agamemnon a lesson. He was even willing to, quote, teach the Greeks a lesson. But he intended to get over his anger. And now, then the question becomes, well, Achilles, if you're getting over your anger, why don't you get back to battle? But Achilles seems to say, in a sense, I gave my word. I stated that I will not return until the Trojans are burning, not the Greek ships, but my ships. And since that hasn't happened, Achilles is almost saying, I'm now bound by my word. I'm not bound by my original anger. That's kind of past, but I'm still not going to do it because I said I'm not, and I'm Achilles. Then Achilles goes on to grant Patroclus permission to wear his armor, take his chariot, take his shield. But he says, listen very carefully. He goes, go out and fight bravely, repel the Trojans, but don't pursue them back to Troy. Do not try to climb the wall of Troy. Just push them back, and then you leave and come back here. That's what Achilles says. And we will see that Patroclus, fighting valiantly in battle, forgets what Achilles says or doesn't take account of it, is so excited by the fact that he's doing so well that he goes all the way to the Trojan wall and he tries to climb it. And that's where he meets the formidable Trojan warrior Hector, who kills him. Now, Achilles is even willing to send the Myrmidons, which is Achilles' own troops, to go fight alongside Patroclus. He obviously wants Patroclus to be protected. And so he gives the Myrmidons a kind of rallying speech. And here is Homer using one more of his kind of unforgettable similes. The Myrmidons closed ranks until there was no more space between them than between the stones a mason sets in the wall of a high house when he wants to seal it from the wind. So here's a mason. He's like, I got to pack the bricks in really tight so that there's absolutely no wind that can pass through. I don't want the people living in this house to be listening to, you know, rustling and shrieking sounds from the wind. And so in the same way, the Myrmidons lock shields, shield to shield. And this gives you an idea of what good fighters they are, how determined they are, how disciplined they are, and how good. So Patroclus is going in supported by the Myrmidons. And then Achilles, as Patroclus leaves, Achilles sort of goes down and prays to Zeus. And he prays kind of a double prayer. He prays for two things. He says, send Patroclus into battle with my men. Send forth glory with him. So he's praying to Zeus, give Patroclus his Aristeia, give Patroclus glory. And then he says, may he come back to me unharmed with all his weapons and his men. And then Homer adds this. Zeus, in his wisdom, heard Achilles' prayer and granted half of it. Yes, Patroclus would drive the Trojans back from the ships, but he would not return from battle unharmed. So here's Homer again giving you, as Homer never hesitates to do, a foreshadowing of what is coming. The power of the Iliad is you actually know what's going to happen. And yet what's going to happen, the inevitability of it, since you know in advance, as by the way, many of the audiences of the Iliad knew in advance, they knew the story of the Trojan War, it gives a certain, you may say, tragic depth and inevitability to the action when it comes. You know it's going to happen, and yet when it does happen, you have this sort of sense that fate could not have been otherwise.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify, or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.